I'm actually quite glad Mark and Mike put up that slide with the intelligence cycle. I hadn't seen it before. With the key thing being strategy. That's the first thing that flies out the window when people start working. Right? And I can give you countless examples of that. I collect them. It's kind of my geeky hobby. After the American embassies were blown up in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in 1998, the Americans launched a kind of risk management exercise into the location of all of their embassies, consulates, and missions overseas. And what they concluded was that the best place for any future embassy would be 30 miles outside of any urban center, buried under the desert, surrounded by razor wire, with a very bendy road leading up to it. Now, I would have thought that the purpose of having an embassy overseas is to have some kind of contact with people on the ground. In other words, the strategy is lost straight away because you focus in the operational weeds. And there are countless examples. Another example, because you're here to learn from your own slides, in the contest strategy, prevent, pursue, protect, prepare. That's all operational. That's not a strategy. A strategy, in my mind, would be for the United Kingdom to project a purpose, to actually have an argument of its own as to what it wants from the 21st century, rather than allowing a bunch of hicks and idiots and, you know, fantasy wannabe terrorists to run rings around them and getting obsessed with them and their ideas instead of articulating ours and working on them. Intelligence, in my mind, is actually two things. It's a combination of information and how you interpret that information. Everyone is obsessed with the information. Everyone in the security world is obsessed with the information, the quality of the information. All the critics and cynics are obsessed with the information that hasn't been provided. And actually the key element is the interpretation of the information. And if your hand's licks, you could say to the United Nations Security Council that you find no evidence for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yeah, there's a piece of information, I find no evidence. I've been out there, I've got my teams looking around, there's no evidence for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But how you read that piece of information depends on your view of the world, yeah? You can either say that's because there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or you can say that's because they're bloody good at hiding them. In other words, how you act is entirely predetermined prior to the information arriving anyway. It's dependent on your framework of analysis, your understanding of the way the world is. And again, let's just have a look at just one example of how a false frame of analysis leads to all sorts of problems. I mean, if you really think that we're facing a global conspiracy of jihadists hell-bent on acquiring weapons of mass destruction and destroying civilization as we know it, then it's probably reasonable to send 200 armed officers to arrest a couple of brothers in East London. In fact, personally, if that really is the enemy we face, maybe 200 armed officers isn't enough. I'm surprised the army wasn't there and the Air Force. On the other hand, if you actually think, well, what we're facing here are a bunch of extremely confused wannabe terrorists, very few of whom have got any hard links with Al-Qaeda or anything else, then that might be seen as a bit of an overreaction. When you look at the list of targets there from Operation Crevice, you know, poisoning people's beer, targeting football fans at football matches, you know, the Blue Water Shopping Centre, and all those slags dancing around at the Ministry of Sound. Well, I'll tell you something, I can't find many of those targets listed in the Quran. Interestingly enough, many of them are almost part of government policy nowadays that also targets the misbehaviour of football fans, young people who drink too much, back in the news today, a shallow consumer culture, of which Blue Water is no doubt, as Chow Central, the highest exemplar of. And, you know, all those slags dancing around, well, the government wouldn't be so gauche as to call it that. They'd have an anti-chlamydia campaign to make the same message. But the point is, you know, where do you think these guys get their ideas from? You know, these people are born here, educated here, absorb a complete mishmash of ideas ranging across the political spectrum from social conservatism, you know, targeting young girls at the Tiger nightclub in Haymarket in London, through to radical anti-consumerism, trying to blow up an airport because of all those proles and morons taking their cheap flights to Malaga and destroying the planet. That's the baggage. And that's a totally different framework of analysis to the one that we're being presented with. If you don't start with that, you're going to make an awful lot of cock-ups. Now, I had thought I was going to come here today to talk to you about uncertainty, and I actually will. And it's kind of interesting to me. In countless presentations, I suppose, over the last few years, when I start getting bored listening to all the speakers that I have to listen to about the war on terror, what I do, I play a little game, and I keep a tally of the number of times they speculate about what if, you know, Saddam had, you know, passed on secrets about weapons, or what might happen if somebody did this, or what could. So if you count the times you hear the word if, might, could, and it actually builds up into quite a frightening extent, actually, to see the extent to which the world and policy is now being driven by the realms of possibility rather than probability or hard evidence. It's not just any possibility or problem. It's invariably worst-case scenarios that people are advised to work out and think about and speculate about. Everybody in the security agencies are busy speculating, extrapolating to the far reaches of possibility. We all know that the Americans after 9/11 hired a bunch of Hollywood film producers to come and advise them as to possible scenarios of what happens next. Now, don't get me wrong, because I often get caricatured. There is nothing wrong with planning. Right? I'm all in favour of it. Real experts in particular positions of responsibility and authority ought to plan for the worst case scenarios. However, when you start acting on your plans as if the things you were speculating about are already true, it is you who is changing the world. The 9/11 Commission in America, the inquiry into what happened, accused American security agents of suffering a failure of imagination. I suspect what's happened now is that the pendulum has gone right to the other end of the spectrum, and people are slightly imagining a bit too much. Like I said, you know, an intention, for instance, an intention of acquiring certain weapons or certain capabilities is not the same as doing it, nor indeed is it a symbol of your capabilities of building a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, if you catch me in the bar afterwards, I might also talk a lot about what I intend to do to certain people or certain institutions, but really, fortunately, people who know me understand that, you know, that's the beer talking or whatever, and, you know, Bill's mouthing off and actually what he's capable of and what he truly wants to achieve may be slightly different. And again, there's been a confusion of chatter that people overhear over, you know, either on the internet or over phone conversations, a confusion of that with real intent and capability, which actually creates huge problems. This presentation now, I don't want to focus just on unknowns, which obviously lots of people talk about, or unknown unknowns, if you're Donald Rumsfeld. It's interesting that when Rumsfeld used that phrase about unknown unknowns in a press briefing in, I think, 2002 now, he was possibly unaware that he had acquired that phrase from the environmental movement, who have actually been using the concept of unknown unknowns for quite some time. You know, that we must act now to save the planet, even before we've got the evidence, because by the time we've got the evidence, it will be too late. So, yeah, they had developed the whole idea of precautionary thinking, which in many ways the neocons adapted and adopted as preemptive strikes. And I hope that, you know, the environmentalists are now happy with the consequences of their kind of ideology. Whether they understand the extent to which they're in cahoots with Rumsfeld, I doubt that that's clear to them. But I think, as I said, that the key really is to have an appreciation of context and real evidence. As a society, so here's a bit of context, yeah? As a society, we have become very, very bad at dealing with uncertainty, you know, let alone unknowns, especially things that are low probability but have a very high consequence. So there's quite a common argument I hear, particularly in public health circles, that you can never be too safe. But actually, you can, you know. You can be so safe that you paralyze your own systems, you can divert all your resources towards targeting something that you're speculating wildly about, distracting your attention from probably more plausible and probable sources of risk, and at the same time you ignore the real drivers of what's making you act in the way you're acting and the threats that you face. I mean, anyone who's read, you know, Shakespeare's Othello will have an understanding of the dangers of being slightly too suspicious, and the power of suggestion which drove Othello to being so jealous that he murdered his wife. Gibbon, in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, wrote, "An imaginary cause is capable of producing the most serious and mischievous of effects." His argument is that in the decline of Rome, people started treating suspicions as facts. Then they started acting on the facts, and it's those actions that brought down the empire. quite a lot of people in some of these discussions say, well, you know, we need to act because, you know, the public wants us to act, the public expects us to act, that, you know, we need to be seen to be doing the right thing. Whenever the word, you know, whenever the public is invoked, it kind of raises my radar of suspicion. Because my personal view is nobody really knows what the majority of the public thinks on many of these things. Precisely in part because the public have slightly disengaged from the political process, you have an endless round of surveys and polls and focus groups, which are invariably self-serving. They start off with a presumed answer, encourage people to kind of regurgitate it, and then present it as some important conclusion. Mostly, the public's name is used for some kind of predetermined agenda. Some suggest that the public are alarmed by, you know, certain aspects of the war on terror. Others are suggesting now that they are far too complacent. Personally, I think, to be honest, it's probably somewhere in between. Possibly it can be influenced. Maybe it's the role of government to influence it. But in some instances, you should ask, is there any need to influence it? If actually the public continue to go about their daily lives in a kind of normal way, isn't actually that the best message we could be sending to terrorists? And there's plenty of evidence that certain of the attempts to kind of inform the public and alert them to the threats that they face have actually backfired. I think those wanting to contribute positively to dealing with some of the problems that we face and not make things worse need to have a better appreciation of the social context, not just some of the content or superficial content of some of these issues. Let me give you a quick example. In 2004, a committee of the Royal Society produced a report called Making the UK Safer, Detecting and Decontaminating Chemical and Biological Agents. Now, as it happens, a long time ago, I did a science degree, and I've got a great deal of respect for the scientists of the Royal Society, and I suspect that what is in their report is actually sound on a scientific basis. However, my view is they didn't really approach the problem they were addressing in a particularly scientific way. Because, you know, the first thing you ought to do in any situation as a scientist is to question the axioms of the debate, not take superficial appearances of things at face value. I mean, in the opening to that report, they say, due to greater public concern about the possibility of chemical and biological agents. Well, there's something to interrogate. Is there really any greater public concern about the possibility of chemical and biological agents? Even if there is, what does that concern represent? Is it a media construct because it's been planted into people's minds and certain they think about it on a continuous basis? Does it represent a broader kind of unease in society, a kind of social fear that's not grounded in any evidence of the possibility of chemical and biological agents, but is simply part of a social mood? You know, that's the kind of question real scientists, and fortunately social scientists, ought to be asking in these situations. After that, you can do your technical exercise of how to decontaminate and all of that, and I'm sure that's entirely rigorous and sound. But the problem is that the Royal Society's own report ends up feeding the fears that they talk about in their opening paragraph. You know, because people look at that and they think, well, my God, if the government's hired the Royal Society to work out how to deal with these things, there must be a real threat. So ironically, it's the Royal Society that are raising public concern about the possibility of chemical and biological agents. It's not just the media, because the usual argument is to blame the media, usually spelt M-E-E-J-A-H, for all of the problems that we face. Well-meaning scientists, as I've suggested, can feed into this problem, as do certain corporations and politicians. Security, let's be clear, is very big business today. I can remember being at the Royal United Services Institute about 4 years ago for a conference where somebody came up to me in a break, who shall remain nameless because it was under Chatham House rules, and he said to me, Bill, what you need to understand is that the supply side of respirators is already in waiting. That's gas masks to you and me. And then he went on to say, I just need something to stimulate the demand. You kind of think, whoa, you know, I just need something to stimulate the demand. Well, don't wish too hard, you know. I mean, obviously, there's an enormous amount of profit to be derived from the war on terror. You'll know, presumably, that some companies are already selling little kits to protect you if you're travelling on the London Underground from supposed chemical and biological incidents. But it's not just the private sector that gains from the war on terror, because it's very easy to sneer at, you know, corporate greed and all of that. But public officials also They don't derive economic capital from the whole thing. They derive moral capital from being seen to be taking the issue seriously, from being seen to be taking the right steps, supposedly, to protect the public. So they too also benefit in some ways. It also provides them with an agenda in a period when, noticeably, they seem to have very few other agendas that to be working on. Politicians who lack any vision for where Britain is going in the 21st century, any sense of direction, any sense of purpose, have repackaged themselves as societal risk managers who will protect us from all of our fears. Those fears, and this is very important, predated 9/11 quite significantly. You can look at a whole series of social concerns and alarms that had developed over a period of about 15 years prior to 9/11. From the fear of eating beef in the aftermath of the mad cow disease episode in this country, the fear of planting genetically modified crops, fears of mobile phones that will fry your brains, vaccinating your children with the MMR vaccine, fears of maverick doctors who might go around killing their patients. Now, of course, there's always an element of plausibility to some of these fears. I mean, there truly was a Harold Shipman who killed a few hundred of his patients. But do you think that the risk management response of government was a proportionate and measured one? There's one Shipman, a bizarre, twisted nutter who killed a few hundred people. And the consequence, the government decided that no GPs in future would be able to carry opiates or strong sedatives on home visits. So the government has nationally instituted pain and suffering for all of you in order to preclude another Shipman. Is that, do you think, a reasonable way of weighing up the risk? We could go into the examples of child abduction, one of which obviously is still prominently in the news at the moment. But I would point out to you that, again, some of the consequences of the fear of child abduction have been far more corrosive and damaging than the rather sick, tragic, and handful of incidents that we're well aware of. We're well aware of them because you know all the names. Sarah Payne, Holly Wells, Jessica Chapman, Madeleine McCann. The very fact that you know the names should tell you this is not that frequent. But the consequence in this country has been the government introducing something called the Safeguarding Vulnerable Groups Act last autumn, which means that any adult who comes into proximity to a child now has to have their criminal records checked. How that's going to stop any paedophile from doing whatever they want, God only knows. But I'll tell you what the real consequence is. We are currently advertising to young children that all adults are potential paedophiles who can't be trusted. I can't actually think of a more corrosive message to be putting out to the next generation. And we've already seen a decline of adults wishing to volunteer to support school fetes, voluntary clubs and associations, Girl Guides, Boy Scouts, all of that, because not just the cost, but just the sheer, you know, kind of, you know, you've known me for 15 years, I've got kids of my own, what, you really want me? Oh, forget it, you know, to go through this process. So just to remind you then that, you know, that is the context within which 9/11 occurred. A context where we were already having a series of fears and scares about all sorts of other things. Now, there's a couple of key drivers for that, which I won't have time to go into in my presentation here this afternoon, but I would suggest to you that the fact that we are now pretty much the most disengaged generation there has been politically since the franchise was universally extended just under 100 years ago is part of the problem, that we no longer wish to participate in the formal decision-making process of our own society. And at the same time, many of our informal social networks have been eroded and undermined, not just families and communities, but membership of out-of-hours clubs, teams, associations, all sorts of other things. The consequence of not taking part in your own society and your informal networks falling apart is that you are living life more on your own than anyone in any generation in living memory. And one of the prices you pay for living on your own is that you're scared of everything. Now, if I put you on your own in the middle of Dartmoor at 3 o'clock in the morning and start breaking a few sticks behind you, you have a very different experience to my putting you there with 30 of your best mates. Right? It's not the risk that's changed, it's your perception that's changed because of your sense of insecurity from your sense of isolation. And that affects policymakers and elites just as much as it affects ordinary people, if not more so. Because actually the lesson from the 7th of July 2005 bombers in London is ordinary people were fairly robust and resilient. They all went, you know, most of them went to work the next day. You could argue they didn't have much choice. Some sources in authority are quite keen to repeat that kind of mantra that the IRA said, you know, we only need to be lucky once, you need to be lucky all of the time. It strikes me that terrorists have been lucky more than once. And actually, they haven't undermined and destroyed civilization as we know it. So that's a bit of a myth. Of course, the media do amplify certain of these scares. I remember when the so-called ricin factory was discovered in North London. I think it was the Mirror which had a front cover with a skull and crossbones on it saying, "It's here," which was kind of feeding into the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq agenda. Worth reminding people that there was never any ricin found subsequently. But also that the media's ability to amplify wasn't because of the media, it fed into the fact that the Health Protection Agency had already been cascading numerous health advisories about the dangers of viral hemorrhagic fever, bubonic plague, tularemia to GPs and the media over a period of 2 years prior to that. We had been softened up to believe that these people are going to come here with chemical and biological weapons. So of course the media would fit that agenda. And just so to show that it's not just the red tops or the tabloids that behave in such a way, I've got a great quote from an official quoted in the Financial Times, who at the time said, this is very profound, "There's a very serious threat out there that chemicals that have not been found may be used by people who have not yet been discovered." Well, you know, once policy is being made on that basis, we're in trouble, right? But those unidentified threats from unknown sources led immediately to a conservative estimate of the US government spending $3 billion developing a chemical and biological weapons counteraction capability, which, by the way, no doubt will help proliferate chemical and biological agents in America to some disgruntled scientist somewhere whose promotion has been overlooked. Interesting times ahead. So just to make the point then, that it's not just the media that drives all of this. I think the key is the decline of other authoritative sources of information in our lives. I've already alluded to the decline of the family, political parties, trade unions. In the past, you didn't just get your information from the media. You used to get it from many other sources.